Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Magic and the Moon podcast. As always, I'm your host, David, and I'm back. It has been quite a long time since I made an episode. I think it was around the end of January. That was kind of a challenging semester for me in school. Things were kind of ramping up as I was heading towards graduation, so I had to take some time away from the podcast as well as other things to kind of just focus on my studies and make sure I finished strongly. And after I graduated, I kind of just wanted to enjoy some downtime and just kind of relax and recuperate from a challenging semester, enjoy the beginning of the summer. So I'm happy to be back, and I appreciate everyone's patience with me as we're waiting for a new episode. And for this week's episode, I've been thinking about how we are kind of coming to the end of Pride Month now, here towards the end of June, and how this kind of overlaps somewhat with Aphrodisia, which was an ancient Greek festival held in the honor of the goddess Aphrodite. And of course, our modern calendar and the month of June and what we know as Pride Month now did not exist in ancient Greece, but I do think it's very interesting that there's some overlap now between those things, because Aphrodite, particularly in the title of Aphrodite Urania, is the patron of same-sex love. So in honor of Pride Month and of the goddess and her festival, we're going to talk about Aphrodite. So for those that perhaps don't know, Aphrodite is a Greek goddess. She's associated with love, lust, beauty, pleasure, passion, procreation, and as syncretized with the Roman goddess Venus, she's also associated with sexuality, fertility, agriculture, and victory in war. Some of her major symbols include seashells, myrtle plants, roses, doves, and swans. And the cult of Aphrodite was largely derived from that of the Phoenician goddess Astarte, who is herself a cognate of the East Semitic goddess Ishtar, whose cult was based on the Sumerian goddess Inanna. Her main cult centers were Cythera, Cyprus, Corinth, and Athens. And her main festival, which I mentioned a moment ago, was the Aphrodisia, which was celebrated every year in midsummer. In Laconia, she was worshipped as a war goddess under the title Aphrodite Aria, meaning the warlike Aphrodite, which also leans into her connections with Ares, which I'm sure go without saying. She was also the patron goddess of sex workers, an association which led some scholars to propose the concept of religious prostitution in Greece and Rome, but we now know that is not correct. In Hesiod's Theogony, which is his kind of epic poem that describes like the origins of the gods, Aphrodite is born off the coast of Cythera from the foam produced by Uranus's genitals, which his son Cronos had severed and thrown into the sea. But we have an alternate story in Homer's Iliad, where instead of being born from the sea foam, she's the daughter of Zeus and Dione. So Plato, in his work called The Symposium, he kind of reconciles these two alternate origin stories, and he asserts that these two stories actually belong to separate entities: Aphrodite Urania, the transcendent heavenly Aphrodite, and Aphrodite Pandemos, who is Aphrodite common to all the people. She had many other epithets and cult titles, each emphasizing a different aspect of the same goddess and used by a different cult. She was known as Cytheria, meaning the Lady of Cythera, and Cyprus, which means the Lady of Cyprus, and that's because both of those locations claim to be the place of her birth. She was married to Hephaestus, the god of fire, blacksmiths, and metalworking, and she frequently had other lovers as well. In Homer's Odyssey, she's caught having sex with Ares, and in the first Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, she seduces the mortal shepherd Anchises. She was also the surrogate mother and lover of the mortal shepherd Adonis, who was killed by a wild boar, which was sent by Ares, who was jealous of their love. Along with Athena and Hera, Aphrodite was one of the three goddesses whose feud resulted in the beginning of the Trojan War, and she plays a major role throughout the Iliad as well. She continues to be featured in Western art as a symbol of feminine beauty, and she's appeared in numerous works of Western literature as well. She's a major deity in modern pagan religions, including Hellenismos, or Hellenism, which seeks to recreate the worship of the ancient Greek deities as close as possible to the ancient past. She's also revered, of course, in kind of eclectic Wicca or eclectic paganism, and the Church of Aphrodite has her as their patron as well. So Aphrodite's name is very interesting. Hesiod says that it comes from the word aphros, which means seafoam, interpreting that the name means risen from the foam, which is referenced from her birth from Uranus's genitals falling into the ocean. Early modern scholars of classical mythology have attempted to argue that her name was of Greek or perhaps Indo-European origin, but these efforts have not really proven anything either way. Her name is generally accepted to be of non-Greek origin, but this can't be said for certain. Scholars in the late 19th and early 20th centuries accept Hesiod's foam etymology as pretty genuine, but they've also analyzed the second part of her name, Odite, meaning wanderer or brightness. More recently, Michael Janda, who also accepted Hesiod's etymology, has argued in favor of the latter of these interpretations and claims that the story of birth from the sea foam as being common throughout Indo-European mythology. Similarly, Christos Witsak proposed an Indo-European compound, abor, meaning very, and de, meaning shine, meaning very bright or shining a lot, and perhaps a reference to the dawn goddess Eos. Daniel Killigan has interpreted her name to mean shining up from the foam or the mist, and other scholars have argued that these theories are unlikely since her attributes are entirely different from that of both Eos and the Vedic deity Ushas. And I kind of briefly earlier mentioned the transition from Inanna to Ishtar to Astarte to Aphrodite, so we're going to kind of explain that in a little bit more depth. The cult of Aphrodite in Greece was imported from, or at least influenced by, the cult of Astarte in Phoenicia, which in turn was influenced by the cult of the Mesopotamian goddess called Ishtar to the Eastern Semitic peoples, and as Inanna to the Sumerians. Pausanias states that the first to establish a cult of Aphrodite were the Assyrians, followed by the Paphians of Cyprus, and then the Phoenicians at Escalon. The Phoenicians, in turn, taught her worship to the people of Kythera. Aphrodite took on Inanna's associations with sexuality and procreation. Furthermore, she was known as Urania, which means heavenly, a title corresponding to Inanna's role as the Queen of Heaven. Early artistic and literary portrayals of the goddess are extremely similar to that of Inanna and Ishtar. Aphrodite, much like Inanna and Ishtar, is also a warrior goddess, particularly as the title of Aphrodite Aria. And Aphrodite's ancient cult statues in Sparta, which are some of the oldest that we have record of, show her holding weapons, which confirms that. Modern scholars note that Aphrodite's warrior goddess aspects appear in the oldest examples of her worship, and they see this as another indication of her origins in the Near East. 19th century classical scholars had a general aversion to the idea that ancient Greek religion was at all influenced by the Near East, but even Frederick Welker, who argued that the Near Eastern influence was largely confined to material culture, still admitted that Aphrodite was of obvious Phoenician origin. The significant influence on Near Eastern culture into the Greek religion, and in particular with the worship of Aphrodite, is now widely recognized as dating to a period of Orientalization during the 8th century BCE, when archaic Greece was on the fringes of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Some early comparative mythologists opposed to the idea of Near Eastern origin argued that Aphrodite originated as an aspect of the Greek dawn goddess Eos, and that she was therefore ultimately derived from the Proto-Indo-European dawn goddess Ushas. Most modern scholars reject that notion now, that she's at least not a purely Indo-European goddess, but it is possible that Aphrodite was originally a Semitic deity, may have been influenced by the dawn goddess. Both Aphrodite and Eos were known for their erotic beauty and aggressive sexuality, and both had relationships with mortal lovers. Both goddesses were associated with the colors red, white, and gold. And Michael Janda etymologizes Aphrodite's name as an epithet of Eos, meaning she who rises from the foam of the ocean, and points to Hesiod's Theogony, at the account of Aphrodite's birth from the sea foam, as an archaic reflex of the Indo-European myth. Aphrodite rising from the waters after Kronos defeats Uranus would then be directly cognate to the Rig Vedic myth of Indra defeating Virta and liberating Ushas. Another key similarity between Aphrodite and the Indo-European dawn goddess is her close kinship to the Greek sky god, since both of them maintain claims to their parent being Zeus and Uranus, who are sky deities. Aphrodite's most common epithet or title was Urania, meaning heavenly. But this title almost never occurs in literary texts, meaning that it likely was only significant in worship and cultic activity. Another common name was Pandemos, meaning for all the people. And in her role as Aphrodite Pandemos, Aphrodite was associated with Peitho, meaning persuasion or seduction, and she could be prayed to for aid in seducing. The character of Pausanias in Plato's Symposium takes differing cult practices associated with different titles of the goddess to claim that Urania and Pandemos are in fact separate goddesses. He asserts that Aphrodite Urania is the celestial Aphrodite born from the sea foam after Cronos castrated Uranus and is the older of the two goddesses. According to the Symposium, Aphrodite Urania is the inspiration of male homosexual desire, note the pride reference, and she is the younger, the older of them, and specifically, she presided over the practice of pederasty, which was a young man, usually like with no beard, kind of athletic, and he would have a relationship with an older man, and he would kind of act as his mentor and kind of assist him in coming of age, and sometimes those relationships were also sexual. So in contrast, Aphrodite Pandemos is the younger of the two goddesses, and she was born from the union of Zeus and Dione, and is the inspiration of heterosexual desire, as well as sexual promiscuity. And Plato says that the homosexual love is the greater of the two loves, and heterosexual desire is the lesser of them. Paphian was also one of her titles, after Paphos in Cyprus, which is said to be the place where she was born. Among the Neoplatonists, and later their Christian interpreters, Urania is associated with spiritual love and Pandemos with physical love. A representation of Urania with her foot resting on a tortoise came to be seen as an emblematic of discretion and conjugal love. It was the subject of Chrysophylline sculpture by Phidias for Elise, known only from a parenthetical comment by the geographer Pausanias. One of Aphrodite's most common literary titles is Philomedes, which means smile-loving, but is sometimes mistranslated as laughter-loving. This epithet occurs throughout most of the Homeric epics, as well as the first Homeric hymn to Aphrodite. Hesiod references it once in his Theogony in the context of her birth, but he interprets it as genital-loving rather than smile-loving. Monica Serino notes that the epithet may relate to the fact that in many artistic depictions of the goddess, she is shown smiling. Other common literary titles are Cypris and Cytherea, which derive from her associations with the islands of Cyprus and Kythera, respectively, because both of them claim to be the birthplace of the goddess. A male version of Aphrodite, known as Aphroditus, was also worshipped in the city of Amathus. Aphroditus was depicted with the figure and dress of a woman, but had a beard, and was shown to be uplifting his dress to reveal an erect penis. This gesture was believed to be an apotropaic, or protective symbol, and was thought to bring good luck on someone who saw it. Eventually, the popularity of Aphrodite waned as the mainstream, fully feminine version of Aphrodite became more popular, but traces of this worship are preserved in the later stories of Hermaphroditus, who is said to be the intersex child of Aphrodite and Hermes. Aphrodite's main festival, which is the Aphrodisia, was celebrated across Greece, but especially in Athens and in Corinth. In Athens, the festival was celebrated on the fourth day of the month of Hecatombeion in honor of her role in the unification of Attica. During this festival, the priests of Aphrodite would purify the temple of Aphrodite Pandemos on the southwestern slope of the Acropolis with the blood of a sacrificed dove. Next, the altars would be anointed and the cult statue of Aphrodite, as well as the goddess Peitho, would be escorted in a majestic procession to a place where they would be ritually bathed. Aphrodite was also honored in Athens as part of the Erephoria festival, and the fourth day of every month was sacred to the goddess. Pausanias records that in Sparta, the goddess is worshipped as Aphrodite Aria, the warlike Aphrodite. This stresses her connection to the god Ares, who was one of her lovers. And it also is recorded that in Sparta, a number of extremely ancient statues of the goddess portrayed her bearing arms, and others were bound in chains, which we have theorized was because they were trying to bind her to the city so that they would be under her protection. Aphrodite was the patron goddess of prostitutes of all varieties, ranging from pomai, which were inexpensive prostitutes who were often like owned as slaves by what we would probably now call a pimp. And there was also the hetere, which were kind of more expensive, well-educated, hired companions that were self-employed and sometimes also had sex with customers. The city of Corinth was renowned throughout the ancient world for many different sex workers and had a widespread reputation for being among the most skilled, but also the most expensive of them in the Greek world. Corinth also had a major temple to Aphrodite, and this is one of the main centers of her worship. And records of numerous dedications to her made by successful courtesans have survived in poems and inscriptions on pottery. During the Hellenistic period, the Greeks identified Aphrodite with the ancient Egyptian goddesses Hathor and Isis. Aphrodite was the patron goddess of the Lagid queens, and Queen Arsinoe II was identified as her mortal incarnation. She was also worshipped in Alexandria in Egypt and had numerous temples in the city dedicated to her. And Queen Arsinoe introduced the cult of Adonis to Alexandria, and many of the women there participated in it. The ancient Romans identified Aphrodite with their own goddess Venus, who was originally a goddess of agriculture and vegetation. And according to the Roman historian Livy, Aphrodite and Venus were officially identified together in the 3rd century BCE, when the cult of Venus Erycina was introduced to Rome from the Greek sanctuary of Aphrodite in Sicily. At this point, Romans adopted Aphrodite's iconography and myths and applied them to Venus. Because Aphrodite was the mother of the Trojan hero Aeneas in Greek mythology, the Roman tradition claimed Aeneas as the founder of Rome, and Venus became venerated as Venus Genetrix, the mother of Rome. Julius Caesar claimed to be directly descendant from the goddess through her son Iulus, and he became a strong proponent of the worship of Venus. This precedent was later followed by his nephew Augustus, and later emperors also claimed succession from the goddess. This syncretism greatly impacted the Greek worship of Aphrodite. During the Roman era, the cults of Aphrodite in many Greek cities began to emphasize her relationships with Troy and Aeneas. They also began to adopt a distinctly Roman kind of iconography of her, and they portrayed her as being more motherly, more militaristic, and more concerned with the city-state. She was claimed as a divine protector by many political figures, and appearances of the goddess in Greek literature also circulated widely, showing Aphrodite portrayed in more and more Roman styles. We talked about the birth of the goddess already, either from the sea foam after Uranus's castration, and also as her being the daughter of Dione and Zeus. But we don't really hear about her childhood. She's always portrayed as being fully grown, very womanly, very sexual, and she's often depicted in artwork being naked. In Homer's Iliad, she is the unmarried consort of Ares, who's the god of war, and is the wife of Hephaestus, who is god of the forge. But in the Iliad, Hephaestus and Aphrodite were never married, and Hephaestus' wife is the goddess Charis. Likewise, in Hesiod's Theogony, Aphrodite is unmarried, and the wife of Hephaestus is Aglaia, the youngest of the three Charites, or the Graces. In the 8th book of the Odyssey, the blind singer Demodocus describes Aphrodite as the wife of Hephaestus and says that she committed adultery with Ares during the Trojan War. The sun god Helios saw Aphrodite and Ares having sex in Hephaestus' bed and warned the god, fashioned a net of gold. The next time they got in bed together, the net trapped them both, and Hephaestus brought all of the gods into the bedroom to make fun of them. After exposing them, Hephaestus asked Zeus for his wedding gifts and the dowry to be returned to him, and by the time of the Trojan War, Hephaestus and Aphrodite were divorced, and Hephaestus had married Aglaia, one of the three Graces. Afterwards, it was generally Ares, who was regarded as the husband, or at least the official partner, of Aphrodite. Aphrodite has many different attendants and divine beings that kind of accompany her, and she was almost always accompanied by Eros, who is the god of lust and sex. In Hesiod's Theogony, he says that Eros is one of the four original primordial beings that was born at the beginning of time. But after the birth of Aphrodite from the seafoam, he is joined by Himeros, and together they became Aphrodite's constant companions. In early Greek art, Eros and Himeros are both shown as idealized, handsome young men with wings. The Greek lyrical poets regarded the power of Eros and Himeros as dangerous, compulsive, and impossible for anyone to resist. In modern times, however, Eros is often seen as the son of Aphrodite rather than a primordial god, but this is actually a relatively later invention of the story. Her other main attendants were the three Charites, also called the Graces, and Hesiod identifies them as the daughters of Zeus and Eurynome, who are called Aglaia, meaning splendor, who is the second wife of Hephaestus, Euphrosyne, meaning good cheer, and Thalia, meaning abundance. And the Charites had been worshipped as goddesses in Greece since the beginning of Greek history, long before Aphrodite was introduced into the pantheon. Her other set of attendants were the three Horae, meaning the hours, whom Hesiod identifies as the daughters of Zeus and Themis, whose names are Eunomia, meaning good order, Dike, meaning justice, and Irene, meaning peace. Aphrodite was also accompanied by Harmonia, her daughter by Ares, and Hebe, the daughter of Zeus and Hera. The fertility god Priapus was also one of her epithets and is the son of Aphrodite and Dionysus, but he was sometimes also described as her son by Hermes, Adonis, or even sometimes Zeus. She had many lovers, including several gods like Poseidon, Zeus, Dionysus, Ares, and Hermes, but she also took mortal lovers as well, and some notable examples of that were Anchises and Adonis. The first Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, which was probably composed around the mid-7th century BCE, describes how Zeus once became annoyed with Aphrodite for causing the gods to fall in love with mortals, so he caused her to fall in love with Anchises, a handsome mortal shepherd who lived near the city of Troy. She appears to him in the form of a tall, beautiful mortal woman while he's alone in his home, and he sees her dressed in bright clothing and extravagant jewelry, and says that her breasts shine with divine radiance. He asks her if she is Aphrodite and promises to build her an altar on top of the mountain if she will bless him and his family. She lies and tells him that she is not a goddess, but is just a mortal and a daughter of one of the noble families of Phrygia. She claims to be able to understand the Trojan language because she had a Trojan nurse as a child. After they make love, Aphrodite reveals her true form, and Anchises is terrified, but she consoles him and promises that she will bear him a son. She prophesies that her son will be the demigod Aeneas, who will be raised by the nymphs of the wilderness for 5 years before going to Troy to become a nobleman like his father. Adonis is perhaps the most famous lover of Aphrodite, aside from Ares, and this may derive from the ancient Sumerian legend of Inanna and Demusid. They engage in a love affair, and the short version of the story basically is that Ares is jealous of their love, and he either sends a boar or he transforms himself into a boar and he gores Adonis to death. The myth of Adonis is also associated with the festival of Adonia, which was celebrated by Greek women every year in midsummer. And the festival, which was probably already celebrated in Lesbos by the time of the poet Sappho, it seems to have become popular in Athens around the mid-5th century. At the start of the festival, the women would plant a garden of Adonis, a small garden planted inside a small basket or a shallow piece of pottery containing a variety of plants that would grow quickly, like lettuce or fennel, and maybe even quick-sprouting grains like wheat and barley. The women would then climb ladders to the roof of their house where they would place the gardens out under the heat of the sun. The plants would sprout in the sunlight but would quickly wither in the heat. The women would mourn and lament loudly over the death of the plants, which were symbolized versions of Adonis. They would tear their clothes and publicly display their grief, mirroring Aphrodite's grief at the death of Adonis. There are many other myths and stories involving the goddess that we will forego for the sake of time. But this is all significant, and we see as we go into the Middle Ages that early Christians often adapted the iconography of the goddess to suit their own purposes. And in the early Middle Ages, Christians adapted elements of Aphrodite and Venus's iconography and applied them to Eve, the first woman of the biblical account, but also female saints, the Virgin Mary even. And we see that Aphrodite is worshipped still, right, to this day. She's revered as a goddess by pagans, and polytheists, and witches, and the like. And as we celebrate her festival of Aphrodisia this year, be thinking of the ways that she plays a role in your life. What role does love play in your life? What role does sexuality and passion and desire play in your life? And particularly at this time of Pride Month, be thinking of Aphrodite Urania, who presides over same-sex love, and my desire for all of you and for myself and for the LGBTQ plus community around the world is that the goddess will continue to bless and protect her people. But that is all I have time for right now. I had a great time with you guys. I'm happy to be back, and I will see you next week.